Okay, so good morning, everybody. Where are we in this study? This is Chapter 6, Reality and the Cosmic Illusion.
Yes, and
And
I think we are at least a couple of paragraphs.
are we in the paragraph beginning in the classical theory of illusionism?
That's what, yes, that's what we.
That's what you have as well. So this chapter is a continuation of the previous one in the sense that here he actually, in the previous one, if it was more like a negative analysis of the, incompatibility of the descriptions of the illusory nature of our experience in terms of dream or hallucination, and also an analysis of mind and its nature extended to Maya and its creative power. This chapter provides a more positive analysis of the relation between reality and the cosmic illusion. So he comes down to what then is the relation between these two in an illusionistic theory. And does it hold water? So that's what we were considering, and he begins by proposing that we look at the relations between these three factors, as he calls them, the percipient, the perception, and the percept. The percipient is who perceives. The percept is what is perceived, in other words, the subject and the object. And the perception is the relation between the two, the perceiving. And so he looks at these three and he says that the way to understand the cosmic illusion would be to look at each of these three in a sense as being real. And the others as being unreal. So it's a kind of a thought experiment in that form. And he starts by looking at the reality of the percept, that is, of the objective universe, and denying or diminishing the reality of the percipient individual and his perceptive consciousness. So that takes him, brings him in the beginning to materialism, modern materialism. And he pushes it into its more contemporary understandings of matter as being a form of energy. And then from there, he moves to considering the similarity between that and Buddhism. In both cases, whatever is presented then becomes sort of, I mean, in the case of energy, the percipient, the percept, in other words, the world universe as we see it, is itself no longer substantial. It takes on a kind of underlying basis in something invisible and insubstantial, but which can be given a certain explanation. So, similarly, in the case of Buddhism, there is nothing substantial, but an underlying void within which there seems to be action. And in both cases, the action that occurs, whether through the movements within energy, an energy field, or whether in a karmic theory, is supported by nothing, is supported by a void. So we find that there is a certain kind of inconclusiveness and even a kind of a, illogicality about these theories. Which we Aurobindo touches on, and then uses that to point to the fact that there could be, just like we are talking about an invisible basis to the material universe, in energy, for example, that there could be consciousness as the substratum of that energy, or consciousness as the substratum of the action that takes place in Buddhism. And Buddhism, in fact, does spawn schools of that kind. We touched on that last time. There is the school of Yogacara, which believes that there is a consciousness within which all these things are occurring. So there are phenomena occurring originally through a kind of accident, and then persisting due to the force of karma, which according to them sprouts just like we have an individual chitta, underlying consciousness, subconscious consciousness, in which everything that we do gets recorded, and that recording contains also the force with which that particular event occurred to us, so that there builds up a certain kind of impulse towards the future. And this is exactly how karmic forces accumulate in this universal consciousness, or what they call the alaya vijnana. In the case of materialism, of course, there isn't the positing of a consciousness underlying energy, but he says that we could very well conceive that there is a underlying consciousness, just as we didn't know that there was an energy, but whose effects were experienced in a material form. So too, a kind of a transcendental empiricism can be posited, where the empirical part of it is material, but that is just the result of a transcendental consciousness. So this is exactly where we are at present. And then he ends by bringing in the notion of being. The question is, if there is a consciousness, whose consciousness is it? Does it actually belong to somebody? Or is it something just floating in the void, just an absolute self, you know, not even, you couldn't even use the word existence. Again, we fall into an illogical trap. So if it is just an accidental appearance in a void, then its stability is under question. It doesn't need to actually be stable. Stability implies being, that there's something which is static, which holds everything. And so this is where he ends that particular paragraph which we were looking at. And we saw how Sri Aurobindo operates in terms of his arguments, where he posits alternatives and shows on the one side their possible illogicality, something a little skewed about the argument. And on the other hand, he also shows, in contrast, glimpses of his own view of things, which seem in comparison to be so much more complete and logical. So he ends that particular paragraph by positing his own view, which is after talking about the insubstantial foundation of energy or consciousness. He says, but these conclusions are not binding. I mean, why should we accept these? What is the pressing need to accept a skewed and illogical theory if there can be a better way of explaining it? So these conclusions are not binding, for behind this consciousness, seizable in its works, seizable in its works only, that is, you know, it's not visible to us, it's not seizable in itself, but in its works only, There may be an invisible original existence. So this is how he's moving from the empirical percept of the material cosmos to an energy form which is available only in its effects, to a consciousness which is available only in its effects as energy, to a being who is available only in its effects as consciousness. See? So there may be an invisible original existence or being. A conscious energy of that existence could then be a reality. Its creations, too, made out of an infinitesimal substance of being, impalpable to the senses, but revealed to them at a certain stage of the action of energy as matter, would be real, as also the individual emerging as a conscious being of the original existence in a world of matter. So we find very interestingly in this formulation, he's showing how the entire substratum, and this is why the importance of the being makes its appearance over here, because the consciousness behind which is the being makes itself apparent as what we know as the percept, that is the cosmic world. But the being makes itself known as the percipient from two ends. In other words, both as that which perceives the cosmos, as the one whose energy is in manifestation, and the one who perceives the cosmos as the self in all perceiving beings. See? So that's the reason why it is revealed to them at a certain stage of the action of energy as matter, as also the individual emerging as a conscious being of the original existence in a world of matter. So consciousness is appearing, or being is appearing through conscious energy as the cosmos, and being is appearing as the conscious self, individual, or person in every creature, in every individual. This original reality might be a cosmic spiritual existence, a pantheos, or it might have some other status, but in any case, there would be not a universal illusion or mere phenomenon, but a true universe. And again, interestingly, we touched on that term pantheos, very interesting term, which sort of theos means divine, pan meaning multiple or animistic in its multiplicity, would be something like a multi-being being, a multi sort of person, we may say. An example of which occurs in the Gita, in the Vishwarupa. Every entity in the cosmos that can be given a name and form is a name and form of that being. That being is the cosmic being with a million or an infinite number of names and forms. That's the pantheos. All is it. All is he or she or whatever we want to call it. So that is how he ends, and that indeed is his view of things. And he shows how not that there is a irrefutable need for it to be that, but that solves all the illogicalities, as well as that sounds intuitively to be a much more true answer. That's how his argument proceeds. So if there are any questions or comments, we can discuss them. Otherwise, we can continue to the next paragraph in the classical theory of illusionism.
So, when you say like the being behind the consciousness or the being that's supporting it, but what does that mean? Like, what is there below the consciousness that can, I mean, isn't the consciousness the being itself? Is like, how do you distinguish between those two? Like, what is he saying are there?
See, he will also go into the various theory, like, for example, the Buddhist theory has nothing under the consciousness. So That's a kind of a paradox. It's an illogical way of talking about things. But one might conceive of some kind of a freak accident that has spawned like a spark. You see, like we talk about something that doesn't have much temporal existence. It's a temporary formation that seems to have appeared like an accident, just as particularly in the philosophical sense, one can think about uncaused appearances. So if there is an appearance without any foundation to it, that appearance of consciousness without any being to contain it would be like a flash. See, I mean, however long that flash may be, but there is nothing to ground it, as it were. See, but a being as the foundation of consciousness means that it is a conscious being, it has consciousness. And he's going to point out how the illusionistic argument is going to posit a being as the foundation of consciousness, but say that, effects can appear within that consciousness which are outside the purview of the being. The being is not conscious. And he's going to naturally kind
Look at
of,
it.
sort of puncture the logic of that. That if it is a conscious being, how come it is not conscious of effects that are going on inside it? So there's the possibility of consciousness existing by itself as a kind of a separation from the being, or consciousness existing as a kind of a, that's why he said in this argument, he said that if we reduce it to that, to the non-being, to the non-existence of the being in a void, then we are talking about a kind of an illogical consciousness. In other words, the consciousness itself is unreal. It's something which exists. I mean, you even can't say use the word exists because that implies a substratum of existence. But its existence is a kind of like a illusory temporary existence that has appeared as an accident. And so he has pulled out the rug from the theory of dream and hallucination. So what kind of existence would that be? I mean, the other analogy that is used is that of the light of a glowworm, or of a, say, methane gas or something which appears and disappears, and we don't seem to know what the real cause was. I mean, he doesn't take that analogy here, but there too, one can say if we probe it, we find that there is a causation to it, there is a substantial basis to it. So, I mean, the answer to your question really is that there is no real answer to how can consciousness exist without being? And there's an illogicality to that formulation, which is what he's bringing.
Okay. Joanna, would you like to start reading? This is page 457. It's the third paragraph on reality and the cosmic illusion, chapter
The
6.
one that starts in the classical theory.
Yes.
Okay. In the classical theory of illusionism, a soul and supreme spiritual existence is accepted as the one reality. It is by its essentiality the self, yet the natural beings of which it is the self are only temporary appearances. It is in its absoluteness the stratum, the substratum of all things. But the universe on the substratum is either a non-existence, a semblance, or else in some way unreally real. It is a cosmic illusion. For the reality is one without a second. It is immutable in eternity. It is the sole existence. There is nothing else. There are no true becomings of this being. It is and must forever remain void of name, feature, formation, relation, happening. If it has a consciousness, it can only be a pure consciousness of its own absolute being. But what then is the relation between the reality and the illusion? By what miracle or mystery does the illusion come to be? Or how does it manage to appear or to abide in time?
So here he begins to look at the other possibility that there is a kind of a reality of a observer in a transcendental reality, a transcendental being. And thereby he sort of flips from the theory of materialism to what is called the theory of absolute idealism, and here are monistic idealism. And that's also the classical theory of illusionism in Indian philosophies. So here a sole and supreme spiritual existence is the one reality, but we have a phenomenal appearance within it of world and beings that are illusory. So this is the foundation of the first quotation with which he began this chapter. Brahman is true, the world is unreal. So he posits that here, you know, the reality is one without a second. It is immutable in eternity. It is the sole existence. So if there is a kind of being, as we talked about last time, a conscious being that contains all things and is all things, it is static, eternal, infinite, immutable, as one of the Upanishads says, without sinews. In other words, it is not divided into parts. It is indivisible. There is no inequalities in it. So how can that be this world, which has got so many entities in it that are changing all the time? They're subject to change. So this is a paradoxical appearance. Hence, it must be illusory. This is how the argument goes. But his question is that if that is the case, what is the relation between the two? Since one is real, the other cannot but be dependent on that one. And what would be the nature of the relationship? How would the two be connected? What is the connecting factor between the two? The real unreal, or unreal real semblance, and the reality that is from which it gets its the sense of its reality.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Yes. As only Brahman is real, only a consciousness or a power of Brahman could be the real creator and a creator of realities. But since there can be no other reality than Brahman, pure and absolute, there can be no true creative power of Brahman. A Brahman consciousness, aware of real beings, forms, and happenings, would signify a truth of the becoming, a spiritual and material reality of the universe, which the experience of the Supreme Truth negates and nullifies, and with which its sole existence is logically incompatible. Maya's creation is a presentation of beings, names, forms, happenings, things, impossible to accept as true, contradictory of the indeterminable purity of the one existence. Maya, then, is not real. It is non-existent. Maya is itself an illusion, the parent of numberless illusions. But still, this illusion and its works have some kind of existence, and so must be in some way, be real. Moreover, the universe does not exist in a void, but stands because it is imposed on Brahman. It is based, in a way, on the one reality. We ourselves, in the illusion, attribute its forms, names, relations, happenings to the Brahman, become aware of all things as the Brahman, see the reality through these unrealities. There is then a reality in Maya. It is at the same time real and unreal, existent and non-existent. Or let us say, it is neither real nor unreal. It is a paradox, a supra-rational enigma. But what then is this mystery, or is it insoluble? How comes this illusion to intervene in Brahman existence? What is the nature of this unreal reality of Maya?
So we see that he continues his method of, you know, this is the Indian method of argumentation, mm-hmm. where you assume your opponent's assumptions or foundations and probe it till it becomes insubstantial and posit in its place something which makes accounts for the insubstantialities. This is exactly what he's doing over here, where he points to the fact that if there is a substratum which is absolute, then anything that arises must have its basis in that. And then if we say that there is a power of consciousness which is creating the illusion of a world or cosmos, then what is the basis of that power? So he goes to the intermediate layer now, instead of looking at the end product, which is the world and its beings. What is it that gives existence to this world and its beings? And how does it relate to the one thing that was true? And the illusionistic theory will say that it is Maya. However, this analysis that he has done so far is not something alien to those theories. They are positing similar things. They are arriving at this logical illogicality. Basically, it is saying that if it is a kind of a creation, then this creative power must have arisen out of Brahman itself. But if we say that Brahman is absolute, immutable, doesn't change, has no transformations within it, is free of time, then how can any power arise out of it to create this universe? So the idea is that we are left with an insoluble mystery, something which is illogical and which is, sort of contrary or contradictory to the nature of Brahman, has arisen within Brahman. So how could that be? And that's why he says, yet we sense a reality in our experience. It switches the picture around to look at the beings and says that the beings can contact Brahman. We can contact Brahman. So if we can contact Brahman, then there must be a reality to this universe. Otherwise, we could not. I mean, the whole idea is if we can recognize this creation as an illusion and arrive at true being, then there must be some truth which is allowing us access to the truth. So we are left with this paradox of an unreality which has a reality to it. That's why he's used that term unreal reality even earlier. Still, this illusion and its works have some kind of existence and so must in some way be real. So then he goes on to talk about both the existence of the power of consciousness as well as of its project or the percept, which is the world and the beings. So he ends with this idea that it is at the same time real and unreal, existent and non-existent. Or let us say it is neither real nor unreal. So then that is the other alternative, that it belongs to some category which is completely outside our understanding, totally incomprehensible. And even our intuitions of pure existence are baffled by this paradox. And as I said, the illusionistic theories go this far. They are logical enough to see it. Shankara was not, he was a master logician, one may say. So he does say exactly these things that Sri Aurobindo is saying, but then ends by saying exactly what he's saying here, that we cannot know what Maya is. Maya is too unfathomable. He says even Brahman doesn't know what Maya is. That's how he ends. And so there is a paradox that is admitted at the very heart of this kind of illusionism. And Sri Aurobindo is highlighting it over here because there's another way of formulating the whole thing. And that's he's going to show that that doesn't need to make this kind of incomprehensibility into the foundation of the cosmos, but rather a gnosis as the foundation of the cosmos, meaningfulness as the foundation of the cosmos, that whatever we consider to be logical can find its culmination in the relation between the supreme existence and its universe, it's the cosmos it creates.
Yes, so when he's making all these, arguments for and against things, he's already coming from a place where, I mean, it's not really logic so much as that he's, it's more an expression of his experience than speculative logic, isn't it?
No, of course, that is the truth of the matter. But interestingly, the form or the formal structure of his argumentation is following the kind of the Indian logic, you may say. Indian darshana logic of darshana follows this very same kind of path, and it arises from exactly what you said, experience. Chaitanya arguing against the Advaitins is also doing the same thing. He's arising out of some kind of substratum of an experience and probing the other view for its inconsistencies and positing the experience that he had as completing those inconsistencies. This is how the method of argumentation in darshana logic proceeds. Now, in some cases, you may go one step further and say, so you may talk about three types of argumentations in the Indian system. The first is something that he takes up in this book itself as the method of Vedantic knowledge. The method of Vedantic knowledge proceeds through intuition. And so also there is an experience behind it. But the logic is not so mentally construed, but it is proceeding through jumps which are jumps of intuitive perception. And it requires a certain kind of a community of conversation in which such, those jumps are being immediately recognized. So there is already the, it's like the, a seer community, a community of seers is moving through cosmic realities and affirming a certain type of vision. On the other hand, you have the kind of darshana logic, which is what we are talking about, that belongs to the level of argumentation that people like Shankara and Madhavacharya and Sri Chaitanya, Ramanuja, those people are following. And then you have a lower level, their disciples, you may say, who follow a similar method but don't have the experience.
Cheerleading, that's more like.
But still, they're kind of like, they believe in the experience of their guru. So they have a certain kind of a foundation in the faith that that which is said is, it's sort of like in our case, you know, we're assuming that, yeah, that that is the reality and therefore let's probe the other view and see why this reality is better than those. Purva Paksha, Uttar Paksha is considered that that is the form of logic.
Mm-hmm. Karen Mitchell, would you like to read next?
Yes. At first sight, one is compelled to suppose that Brahman must be in some way the percipient of Maya. For Brahman is the sole reality. And if he is not the percipient, who then perceives the illusion? Any other percipient is not in existence. The individual who is in us, the apparent witness, is himself phenomenal and unreal, a creation of Maya. But if Brahman is the percipient, how is it possible that the illusion can persist for a moment, since the true consciousness of the percipient is consciousness of self, an awareness solely of its own pure self-existence? If Brahman perceives the world and things with a true consciousness, then they must all be itself and real. But since they are not the pure self-existence, but at best are forms of it, and are seen through a phenomenal ignorance, this realistic solution is not possible. Yet we have to accept, provisionally at least, the universe as a fact, an impossibility as a thing that is, since Maya is there and her works persist and obsess the spirit with the sense, however false, of their reality. It is on this basis that we have then to face and solve the dilemma.
So he continues here with the same argument that if we are saying that Brahman is the sole reality, then it must be the percipient of Maya. In other words, Maya cannot operate without the knowledge of Brahman. Brahman is fully aware of whatever is happening within Maya. And if that is the case, then whatever is arising through Maya is happening with the consent of Brahman, even perhaps the very will of Brahman. So this is the illusion, you know, having a reality from the side of the Brahman. But if it is an illusion, then how could that be? Again, the logic founders on a paradox. And on the other hand, saying you cannot then say that the individual is the percipient, because the individual is just an effect. And yet for that effect, if we then you can kind of twist the equation around us another to the third item, that is what is the percept of Brahman. Ultimately the individual is becomes the percipient. If that becomes the percipient, then Maya becomes real. To it, Maya is completely real because the universe is real and in its experience. And that reality is something which, from the other point of view, is being posited as an illusion. So this double paradox, the paradox of a percipient, of Brahman as the percipient, who is yet perceiving the action of its own consciousness, which somehow is escaping its own perception. And on the other hand, the perception of an illusory effect, the individual perceiving an illusion or an illusory cosmos, that to it is the only reality there is, are the two sides of a double bind paradox, we may call it, that need to be explained.
Devashish, would you say that if you're an illusionist, you accept paradox, and so these arguments are not really relevant, because basically what you're saying is we can't know.
Right.
And in other words, we're saying the universe as we experience it is not meaningful. There's no way to make it intelligible.
Exactly. So here we can talk about two levels of paradox. One level of paradox is, you know, what what in Greek is called an aporia, which is like a dead end. Like if we are trying to posit the reality of the one and saying that the many are therefore false, there can only be one. Or if we posit the reality of the many, pluralism, and say that the one cannot be true because there are always more and more into an infinite, proliferation, then we come to a dead end, what is called an aporia. Then the aporia is solved only by saying that the two sides of the contradiction that we are looking at are the same. The one is infinite, and infinity is the one. This is the transcendental, kind of perception towards which this type of paradox leads. That is the paradox of the koan, so to say. The paradox that logically comes to a dead end, but flashes into a transcendental experience. Jumps, it's like a quantum jump to the source of the paradox. But there is another kind of paradox, which is what is being talked about here, another level of paradox, where that reconciliation even is not possible. Even in the reconciliation that we talked about, there is a meaning. We can say that to assert that one and infinity are the same is a higher level gnosis that gives meaning to their discontinuity in our experience. But if we come to another kind of paradox where we say that we cannot even posit any sort of reconciliation, because one of the sides of these of this incompatible duality escapes the foundation of the other, is mysterious to the other. Like if we say that Maya is mysterious to Brahman, then we are actually asserting a dualistic cosmos, but we don't want to admit it. This is the reason why illusionism in the Shankarite sense ends up becoming a dualism, though by a sleight of hand, he makes it appear to be a monism.
So do you think that excuse me, Sri Aurobindo is appealing to a excuse me, to a modern sense of the like a scientific sense that the universe is intelligible, that investigation is worthwhile, like a humanism or something like that. Or does it seem to you that he's really speaking to the Indian experience of illusionism and Maya, or maybe both?
Yeah, I think the first thing that you mentioned, John Robert, is very true. I think that that's the reason why he pays so much importance to supermind, because supermind is a Gnostic instrument. Supermind is essentially what gives meaning to the cosmos and to reality, to the ultimate or absolute reality manifesting as the cosmos. So it is meaningful. It's not just a humanism. Humanism sort of demands rationality. You're quite right. Humanism demands that we find reason in all things. But this is a kind of a extrapolation of humanism, one may even say a post-humanism, because it is demanding the presence of a kind of super reason, a type of Gnostic understanding which surpasses the logic and yet gives meaning, grants meaning to everything. But there is a logic of the infinite, as he calls it, earlier in The Life Divine. So that is definitely one of the subtexts of his entire work. And I think it, you know, when we say that, is he answering the Indian tradition? Yes, he's answering the Indian tradition, but it's almost as if the Indian tradition in its demand for logical argumentation is assuming this and yet denying it. This is one of the paradoxes that is subtextual to this entire argument. That why would a sort of a thinker like Shankara be so rigorous in his analysis and then dive into this incomprehensibility, which is inexplicable? He might as well have not just gone into the ineffable to start with and say the creation is inexplicable. There is only a truth, and the rest of it is inexplicable. We have to just get out of it. If you go for trying to explain it, then you have to also see if there is a way by which you can explain it. And that's the intuitive drive in Sri Aurobindo's argument, is saying that, can we see something that explains it? Is it meaningful?
Yeah, very good. When I mentioned humanism, I didn't mean that he was just repeating humanism, but that he was appealing to that, that kind of mindset.
Yeah, I agree. He is appealing to that mindset, and I think you know, it's an apt analogy or apt description, because I think humanism begins exactly with that kind of intuition that there is a rational explanation to the cosmos and its reality, and yet the limitations of humanism, you know, stick it to the rational faculty of the human. But he is extrapolating that in a way. He's assuming that intuition, that he's assuming the rightness of the intuition of searching for meaning in a kind of a super reason, one may say.
Thank you.
Debashish, I'm wondering what the underlying experience of the illusionist or the monist, was it suffering? Was it human suffering? That the experience of human suffering and the prevalence of it, that made them move in that direction of there is only the one?
Yeah, I would agree that is the case. There is another side to it, though, which is that there is a gulf between what is called the knowledge and what is called the ignorance. In other words, vidya and avidya. So that gulf is not bridgeable so easily. You know, that this paradox that he's talking about, on one side, there is the immutable absolute, something which never changes. And on the other side, there is this changing cosmos. This way of seeing things and this paradox between these two realities is a real paradox. And this paradox arises because the cosmic mind, not our minds, but our minds are essentially operating by the laws of the cosmic mind, which already creates these big oppositions and opposites, you see, distinctions that are not bridgeable by the mind, because it is already under the operation of the cosmic mind. And so we may easily have spiritual experiences of this kind that may come to us even unbidden, even if we don't admit the suffering nature of the cosmos. As in Sri Aurobindo's own case, I mean, his first experience was exactly this kind of experience. It was an illusionistic experience that he had in Baroda, meditating with Lele. And so the question is, why didn't he stop there? It's very compelling to believe it. The answer is that something in the human nature is not satisfied with that. Again, it is the search for a higher meaning, a meaning that transcends this. That's something we carry which is greater than the cosmic mind, that has an intuition of the supermind. Let's put it like that. And the cosmic experience may be so overwhelming that it may quench that. And this is what has happened in the past, that once you have an experience of that kind, you take it to be absolute. And then you try to give it reason and explain it. And this is what people like Shankara, etc., have done. They have given explanations to their experience, which was so compelling to them that they couldn't go beyond it. But Sri Aurobindo is saying that there is a way beyond. There is a kind of a path that leads out of this gulf between the vidya and the avidya in the experience of the cosmos.
So it's the eternal no and the eternal yes of savitri?
Sort of like that, yeah. Yeah. This dichotomy, whether you call it the eternal no and the eternal yes, which is really the kind of the fight with death, or in this case, the immutable one and the changeful many, these two ways of looking at the reality and positing them as separate, as different, is intrinsic to mind. And it arises as a property of the cosmic mind. That's the reason why cosmic mind creates these types of opposites and does it so that, you know, a dialectical process may emerge for the evolution of consciousness.
Thank you, Devashish.
Keka, would you like to read next?
Yeah, sure. One.
So if Maya is in somewhere real, right?
Yeah.
If Maya is in some way real, the conclusion imposes itself that Brahman, the reality, is in that way the percipient of Maya. Maya may be this power of differentiating perception. For the power of Maya, consciousness which distinguishes it from the true consciousness of soul, spiritual self, is its creative perception of difference. Or Maya must be, at least, if this creation of difference is considered to be only a result and not the essence of Maya force, some power of Brahman's consciousness. For it is only a consciousness that can see or create an illusion, and there cannot be another original or originating consciousness than that of Brahman. But since Brahman is also self-aware, forever, there must be a double status of Brahman consciousness. One, conscious of the soul reality. The other, conscious of the unrealities to which by its creative perception of them, it gives some kind of apparent existence. These unrealities cannot be made of the substance of the reality. For them, they also must be real. In this view, one cannot accept the assertion of the Upanishads that the world is made out of the supreme existence, is a becoming, an outcome or product of the eternal being. Brahman is not the material cause of the universe. Our nature, as opposed to ourself, is not made of its spiritual substance. It is constructed out of the unreal reality of Maya. But on the contrary, our spiritual being is of that substance, is indeed the Brahman. Brahman is above Maya, but he is also the percipient of his creations, both from above and from within Maya. This dual consciousness offers itself as the sole plausible explanation of the riddle of a real eternal percipient, an unreal percept, and a perception that is a half-real creator of unreal percepts.
One can actually imagine that the Sri Aurobindo is having a tongue-in-cheek kind of laugh at all this while maintaining this kind of logical argument, you see. Because it's also interesting that he's using a method which is something that one might call part of the prescription for an integral education, which is that one shows the totality of what is to come even in the steps of the learning. That as you introduce the steps, yet you provide glimpses of the truth, of the end. So we see that constantly with Sri Aurobindo. We find that even when he opposes his own view, that at some point he'll give a glimpse of that view. And in this particular paragraph, we find that he gives the most complete view that he has given so far, and then suddenly pulls the veil over the view, as it were. So he begins by kind of saying that, again, that logically, if Brahman is the only reality, then Maya And if Maya has any kind of reality, as we saw in the previous paragraph, then Maya must be, Brahman must be the percipient of Maya. And Maya must be a kind of consciousness that cannot have a reality outside of Brahman, see. So that's how he begins by looking at the two ways in which Maya can be a kind of a consciousness of Brahman. Firstly, it may be Brahman's own consciousness of differentiation, its power of differentiating perception. In other words, in what way does Brahman perceive Maya? Brahman may not be perceiving Maya. Maya may be Brahman itself, and it's maybe the perception of Brahman differentiating its contents into a temporal and spatial cosmos, a cosmos with entities and progression, which are the subjective realities, the qualitative realities of time and space. On the other hand, it may not be that, but there may be a layer between the absolute reality of Brahman and the relative reality of Brahman. In other words, two statuses to Brahman. And Sri Aurobindo posits all these as truths in his other works, that in fact, Maya is nothing but the differentiating consciousness of Brahman, the creative consciousness of Brahman. And Brahman can have a creative consciousness. It is not necessary for Brahman to be only a pure observer. So this is the problem of consciousness taken to be only something that can observe, inert, which is also the proposition that Sankhya believes in. And this kind of a position given to consciousness as pure observer, is something which is, again, a product of the mind, which makes this distinction between that which observes and that which acts as being two contradictions. But as a matter of fact, creative consciousness emerges out of Brahman itself. Brahman has its own property of observing itself in different ways, which are its creative abilities. So its creative property of seeing itself as a power of differentiation is what is called Maya. Now, on the other hand, if we want to say that that way of looking at itself cannot, in fact, abrogate its own inviolable, unchanging immutability, if that is to be the case, then Brahman must actually have a subsidiary reality to itself. That is, Brahman creates, as it were, or looks at itself, as it were, as capable of changing. See, and Sri Aurobindo uses the term elsewhere of the passive Brahman and the active Brahman to account for these two statuses. It is in the active Brahman that the Maya, differentiating consciousness of Maya, operates, or as the active Brahman, you may say. They are the same. The active Brahman is Maya in its differentiating capacity. So he points to all this, says that Maya may be his power of differentiating perception, for the power of Maya consciousness, which distinguishes it from the true consciousness of soul spiritual self, is its creative perception of difference. That is the truth of Maya. And its truth arises out of Brahman's ability to perceive itself like that, its own infinity. And then the other view, which is that to do that, Brahman must divide itself, or Maya must be, at least, if this creation of difference is considered to be only a result and not the essence of Maya force, some power of Brahman's consciousness. So this is the power of Brahman's consciousness, one of its forms of consciousness that can, then he turns out, that can differentiate its properties, but then he pulls the veil again by calling it an illusion. So he's going back by giving you, first gives you a glimpse of his view of things, then goes back to the argument to assert the illusionistic view. So he says, only a consciousness that can see or create an illusion, and there cannot be another original or originating consciousness than that of Brahman. So it has to belong to Brahman, yet it has to somehow be separate from Brahman so that it can create some type of an illusion, an effect, just a phenomenal effect. But again, that's a paradox. But since Brahman is also self-aware forever, there must be a double status of Brahman consciousness. So this is the double status. One conscious of the soul reality, the other conscious of the unreality. So in that case, it's not unreality. In his view, both are realities. One is the reality of its immutable self, its transcendental self beyond manifestation, and the other is its property of self-manifesting, presenting itself in all its infinite, variety. So then he talks about this in terms of the two poles that we introduced earlier, that it is inviolable in itself, and it is also it's the observer of this power of manifestation, and it is inviolable within the manifestation as the observer within the self. See? So it is in both ends, but between them is this subsidiary consciousness of manifestation, which is producing effects that we can take to be illusory. See? So this is a way of speaking, and he says this would reconcile this problem. It does, and we actually only have to make one small change to this formulation and say that which seems to be unreal only is a seeming, because it is also Brahman that has become that. Therefore, it is real. See, but he presents it in this form and tries to get Shankara out of his own paradoxical ditch, pull him out by saying, this is a way in which it can be solved. Mm-hmm. But the unreal percept part still contains a paradox, which is the paradox is, if Brahman has become this, if it is a power of Brahman, then whatever it projects cannot be an illusion. It has to be based on the substance of Brahman. So this is the thing about substantiality of the immutable and substantiality of the cosmos, that the second has to have its basis in the first. It cannot be a consciousness that there may be the appearance of a gulf, which is what we were saying, the gulf between Vidya and Avidya. The appearance of the gulf is created by a certain property of Maya. That's why the illusion-ness or illusory-ness of this world in the experience of the Advaitin has a certain kind of reality to it.
So, do the illusionists when we use a term like Brahman, it already, it biases everything against illusion, because we have this bias of Brahman being real. Do illusionists use that term, or is that something that Sri Aurobindo and others are projecting onto them as something that they use?
No, they use the
term. They use the term Brahman as something real?
Yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh. So
their whole argument is based on the fact that there is only one reality, and that is Brahman.
So then when they accept the possibility of this one reality, so then what are they saying is the illusion?
The illusion is, they're saying there is an illusion because that one reality cannot have any changes in it. It has to be changeless. It has to be eternal. It has to be static. So if that is the case, then why is there this world of separate beings that don't have any experience of that one reality? Why are they, kind of moving around, changing, evolving, dying, being born and reborn? Why is that happening when Brahman is the sole reality that never changes? It's like the absolute and is eternally the same. and one. So it's a contradiction to that definition of the reality.
Is the term that Sri Aurobindo uses, active and passive Brahman, is that something that has a historical context in Indian philosophy, or did he?
No, he coined those terms.
Amazing.
He coined those terms. He coined those terms out of his own experience, because his first experience was exactly what he's talking about. The world became unreal and Brahman alone was true. And yet he couldn't accept that as the ultimate explanation for his existence. And so he just stayed in that condition until in the jail, of course, there are other schools, the school of Shakti, Tantra, for example, and then the school of Vaishnavism called Vishishtadvaita, which in many ways he is closer to than this. In the school of Tantra, they would attribute this differentiating perception of Maya, they would call it Shakti, because Shakti is conscious energy, it's energetic, consciousness as energy. And in the Vaishnav schools, they would say that all the Supreme Person has become all these entities and is playing in the world in many forms and names. So they would give a reality to this active power of Brahman, one may say. In the case of the tantrics, they would give it the power of consciousness, but they wouldn't actually connect that consciousness to... They also have a problem. There is a gulf. That gulf is actually real. So the gulf, the reality of the gulf, comes from exactly the operation of the cosmic mind. You may see that the nature of immutable self or immutable Brahman is different. There is a kind of a contradiction between that nature and the nature of the active Brahman. And if so, it may be better, I mean, according to the tantrics, to call that the activity of the Shakti rather than to call it the active Brahman, and then say that Shakti is nothing other than consciousness, which arises out of Brahman as one of his properties, Chit, of the Sat Chit Ananda. And then in the case of the Vaishnavs, Ramanuja, etc., they would say that Brahman in and by itself, like they reverse the Shankarite idea of Brahman being immutable and all that, and say Brahman is not unchanging, immutable, and still, but Brahman is constantly in manifestation. And it is multiplying itself for the enjoyment of its own variety.
So Sri Aurobindo bridges this gulf through his experience.
Yeah.
And he creates a unique language.
Yes.
Anyway, I always am amazed. It doesn't seem like Sri Aurobindo gets the credit he deserves.
It's very true. You know, so you're absolutely right. He creates his own language. He needs to create his own language because these words don't exist. And this is the very interesting thing, because as a modern individual, his hybrid consciousness then pulls from both the traditions of East and West. And that's why these words, which had some reality long back, ancient Indian texts like the Upanishads and the Veda don't mean anything in the Indian tradition later times. So Vijnana, which he translates as supermind, he has to use a word like supermind, because nobody would really accept Vijnana, or they'd be totally confused by it if he was to continue to use the word Vijnana like he uses the word Brahman. He has to coin new terms like active and passive Brahman to make this difference, because otherwise already everybody understands Brahman to be only passive.
Thank you.
Debashish, I have a very basic question, and that is, what did Sri Aurobindo see as the relation between the cosmic mind and consciousness?
So, the cosmic mind that we are talking about as something which divides, it's the differentiating consciousness, which is exclusively differentiating. It doesn't keep the power of uniting that which it has divided, right? That cosmic mind is an operation of consciousness, but that operation of consciousness is already self-limited. It's an objectifying operation of consciousness. Consciousness can operate in other ways as well, and consciousness can operate in a way in which it keeps the sense of unity as well as the sense of differentiation, both in its own perception. If it were to do that, then we'd have another kind of cosmos, a cosmos in which we'd experience multiplicity, change, and at the same time know that this multiplicity and change are all the pantheos, as he calls it, the multiple names and forms of the one and the transformations of the one. See, not just understand it mentally or posit it as a philosophical possibility, but have an ontological experience of that kind. That is exactly what he's saying is going to be the nature of a supramental creation. And that is the nature of the supramental manifestation in supermind. But in cosmic mind, this kind of gulf is created so that there may be an evolution out of loss to the gaining of this intrinsic knowledge of the divine, as it were, the self-knowledge of the divine. Brahman as passive and active at the same time, Brahman as the being whose power makes it into this cosmos.
Thank you.
So I hope I answered your question. So cosmic mind is nothing other than consciousness operating through a certain limitation of its own powers.
Could it also be imagined as kind of inner and outer, the outer being the cosmic mind?
Cosmic mind is also an inner being. If you're saying that, is it an objectification of pure consciousness? You might say that it is an objectification of pure consciousness because it does hide its own subjectivity at a certain level. Yeah. From that point of view, yes, it could be thought of as outside and inside of the same of the cosmos, you may say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
While we're talking about these different terms of mind, earlier in the Life Divine, he uses the term divine mind.
Yes.
And I think he says, if I remember correctly, I think he says that that's the mind that differentiates but doesn't lose the
exactly
the understanding of or the pers- uh, experience of unity behind.
Exactly, exactly. So that is, that indeed is the same as supermind. And that is, you know, the origin of the cosmic mind. But that puts upon itself a limitation by removing, or we may put it another way, by inserting a veil, or inserting what he calls the golden lid from the Upanishads, so that it loses the sense of the one and only experiences the changes of the many.
So you answered my question, which was if it was the same as supermind.
Yes.
Thank you.
So there's divine mind and cosmic mind, and similarly, our cosmic mind would also be overmind. The cosmic mind at its heights is what he also calls overmind. And the Maya, again, is what he differentiates into the divine Maya and the overmind Maya. He talks about two Mayas, which are what he's talking about here, the differentiating consciousness of Brahman, either at the level of the divine consciousness or at the level of the cosmic consciousness.
So it just occurred to me that maybe there's another level here, because if divine mind is the differentiation that doesn't lose perception of the unity of the Brahman, right? That's the overall. It seems like the cosmic mind also has a sense of unity. It's not at the Brahman level, it's at the level of whatever cosmic entity it's reflecting. And it's, I don't know if I'm expressing it.
Yeah, you're right. There is a sense of unity at the cosmic mind too. It's the sense of the unity of inclusion. It's the inclusiveness. It's the, you may say, the community of all souls. It's that kind of holism where everything coexists. That is the sense of the overmind, in fact. But the difference between that and the supermind is that the unity of the supermind is a complex unity. In other words, each entity there is the total, is the whole. While here it is the inclusivity of the whole, there it is the transcendental identity of the whole in each.
I have to think about that a little bit, because where I'm going with it is that in the collective practice, it seems like the most accessible perceptions are in a group are similar to the cosmic mind. And
birds are very happy, it looks like. They like the discussion.
Oh, they are. I wish you could figure out what you're saying. But when we're working and we get a sense of coherence,
right?
It's intuitive. It breaks through that differentiation.
Right.
And so, which makes that collective work a way to actually learn to access to understand the perceptions of the unity and possibly even start to access and comprehend in a complete way,
Yeah, no, you're right, Joanne. The thing is that there is a, you know, as he says, that the unity of Brahman is present everywhere, but our perception of that unity has been attenuated and has been given an outward turn so that we see things as more crystallized in an objectified form. So when we turn towards the intuitions of unity, we begin coming into contact with these forms of unity. One of them is synergy. We can actually sense a certain kind of give and take at a deeper level that is going on all the time between beings at a subtle level. Another is a kind of commonality. We may contact a intuitive unity among a certain group of people. We may also form what might be called a collective soul. These things are all operations within the differentiating capacity of the cosmic mind, but they do not reach their fullness, absoluteness, until we go into supermind. But we have to do what you're talking about. This is the only way to proceed. We proceed from unity to greater unity by turning within and starting to form these, powers. In the summit of overmind, there is no distinction between supermind and overmind. It is almost the same. He says that there is basically just the slightest kind of sense of a kind of a division, a change, a kind of a shift of a medium, a medium of consciousness. But we have to, kind of look at the various formations of unity that are available to us and expand them. That is one way by which we can rise to higher degrees of this oneness and differentiation at the same time.
So just,
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Joanna.
The idea of practice is what we need in place to try to move along that path.
Yeah, that is one way, of course. A certain kind of, it comes with its own dangers. Of course, everything comes with its dangers. Its dangers is the danger of the, of the subversion of the collective due to egos that are unable to move forward and kind of derail the whole thing and cause, kind of confusion in the individual. The other way, of course, is through restricted or controlled access to collectives. In other words, one has to look to one's own connection with the one and try to amplify it in one's relations with others. There are many ways of proceeding. So this is one way of proceeding.
And I think that the dangers that you're talking about are actually opportunities as well, because in my experience of working with collective groups, we can be mirrors for each other to help each other in action to understand the ego issues and many other issues that arise in the group so that they can accelerate the awareness. So, I mean, it can be a danger, but it could also be an opportunity.
It is an opportunity, but everybody has to use their own intuition in this negotiation, because it may have worked in the cases that you're talking about, but the opportunity may be in the difficulties may be insuperable in certain cases. You may have the faith that in all cases we might overcome. But in reality, it may not work like that, because we don't know what is the density of darkness. Mm. That density of darkness, the kind of darkness that hides in human hearts, is not so apparent until one really encounters it.
Yeah, that's very true. But it also is an opportunity to become conscious of what those limitations are and know when to back off.
Sure.
When the mother talks of this is a real adventure, in some ways, I mean, is she even referring to the fact that, like, all these darknesses lurking behind?
Yeah, of course. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, like, the word adventure has an exotic, like, romantic feel to it, but it may hardly be the case unless you have the attitude of the mother.
Yeah, just like that. Trolls and goblins and all your things that you encounter in adventure games are all hidden inside us, you know.
And, which is nice when you read about them or...
Yeah, it's not so nice when you encounter them in reality. But, that's the thing. One has to make the attempt and one has to follow one's intuition and one's experience. Because depending on the experience, you'll be guided into doing what is necessary.
You know, there's no need to invite it.
There's no need to invite anything, yeah.
Amazing. So if there are no more questions, we can stop for today and continue 2 weeks out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.